You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Green Left Weekly Radio.
There's one newspaper that is independent of powerful capitalist interests, and that is Green Left Weekly.
It's the people's voice, committed to human and civil rights, ecological sustainability, democracy and equality. It presents ideas that the mainstream media won't.
Green Left is a leading source of local, national and international news with analysis, discussion and debate to strengthen the anti-capitalist movement.
It helps expose the lies of the capitalist press and puts the voices of the marginalised and the oppressed at the centre of fighting for a better world and helps us understand the political developments unfolding around us.
And good morning, listeners. You're listening to 3CR, 8:55 a.m. on your dial, or perhaps you're tuning in to the online website. So you're listening to Green Left Radio, and with me in the studio, you've got myself, Stephanie, Chloe.
Hi, Steph. Hi, listeners. And hi, Zane.
And Zane. Right. Zane is back. Back from gallivanting, Zane. Just figuring out some light.
Top of the morning to yous. It's good to be back on the horse.
Awesome.
Just been away in Europe for months, visiting the in-laws and gallivanting around.
Yeah, that's so good. So before I ask you about, because I'm really curious about your trip and wanting to know what you got up to, because I've seen some of your photos, we'll just acknowledge the traditional owners of the land. Okay. So 3CR and Green Left recognise that this show is being broadcasted from the land of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people, the original rightful sovereign owners, storytellers and caretakers. Australia was founded on the genocide and dispossession of the first people, and we recognise that this attempted genocide is ongoing. As socialists, we pledge to actively support decolonisation. We stand with all the First Peoples in their struggle for justice and rights their land the world over. So, Zane, welcome back. How was your trip? What was the highlight? Any radical things that you got up to?
Yeah, probably one of the highlights was visiting Barcelona and doing a Spanish Civil War walking tour. So we learned about just the horrible role of the Catholic Church in Spain and the way that, the regressive way that religions, not just Christianity, but in other religions as well, can typically be used to support the status quo, support the existing oppressive system. And so in the early 20th century, Spain was still this kind of not quite feudal, but this kind of agricultural sort of society that was about growing crops and textile inputs, cotton and stuff like that. And it was a sort of a fading colonial power. And the progressive Popular Front government was elected in 1931 on a program of more rights for women, more rights for workers and unions. And at that time, you also had a really big build-up of, anarchists in the unions. Anyway, we could probably have big one-hour chat about Spain.
So interesting. Thanks for that. That sounds awesome. So we've got a really packed show today, actually. We've got three interviews. So I hope everybody listening has, got a cup of Morning Joe or whatever beverage you like this early. We'll of course be just having a bit of a chat about an update on Palestine. We've got a number of interviews planned for this morning. We'll be checking in with Sue Bull, who's a unionist and longtime socialist, regarding an upcoming seminar, Relevance of Marxism Today. And then at 7:40, Zane's probably quite excited for this one, as we all are. We're having an interview with Nathan Bell, who wrote a book, and called 1 Minute to Midnight. So that will be at 7:40. And then at 10 past 8, we will be chatting to Helly from Coalition for the Protection of Racehorses regarding Nup to the Cup and the awful racing industry and what we can do to stop all of that cruelty. Yeah, so that should be a pretty exciting show.
Rock and roll.
Rock and roll, yeah. Yeah, but first we might just have a little bit of an update maybe around, yes, obviously it's been another really big week for the poor people of Palestine with scenes at a ceasefire and phase one of a peace plan was agreed to between Hamas and Israel as of yesterday. yesterday our time anyway. And yeah, I'm not sure, Zane, if you've been able to catch up on that yet, but otherwise, is that something you've...
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's, in one way, a ceasefire is welcome because it means that the relentless bombing of Palestinian civilians and housing will stop. And hopefully it stops permanently. But I guess the other side of this deal, which has really been cut with the Palestinians, absolutely their backs to the wall and not really in a position to be able to agree. And you could see that in the language from Trump, which was like,
yeah,
either agree to this or Israel is just going to amp up the bombings of Gaza even further, which is hard to comprehend. How could it be any worse?
Yeah.
But I'm sure that they were willing to demonstrate how it indeed could be worse.
Yeah.
And so possibly the most objectionable part of that deal was this setting up of a new authority that will run the Palestine. Hamas is to be excluded from that. This idea that Hamas can be excluded and like... Okay, I'm not necessarily a Hamas supporter, but Hamas is a resistance organization that's been fighting against the invasion and occupation of Palestine since their inception in the 80s. The idea that others can say that Hamas is not a legitimate, is not allowed to play any part is a huge double standard because...
Yeah.
If we're saying that because Hamas has killed civilians, then they're not allowed to be part of the government. Then
why isn't Israel being forced to disarm, given that they're not just a threat to Palestine, but all the countries around them?
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah, that demand for Hamas to demilitarise, it just implies that Hamas and Israel are on equal footing, which is
not the case at all. And, like, yeah, regardless of, definitely don't support everything Hamas says or does, but... the Palestinians have a right to resistance as well. Like, the basic understanding that you don't want to... And, and I say this being... I'm a full-on hippie pacifist as well, and I don't like conflict or violence, but, it's pretty easy for me to say that when I'm not the one being bombed over here in my privileged first world. I think... Yeah, like when you sort of compare the discourse around Palestine to Ukraine, it's pretty stark, isn't it? Where, we've even been supplying, weapons and most of the world is, maybe not most of the world, but a lot of the global north countries have been aiding, supplying arms to Ukraine to defend themselves. And that's seen as legitimate defence, whereas the Palestinians, God forbid... they resist it all. And, like, when you compare the death toll and, like, the level of atrocities and war crimes, there's just no comparison. Like, it's so just one-sided. It's not... The resistance that Hamas has played is just a drop in the ocean compared to the slaughter and, open impunity that Israel has perpetrated war crimes and genocide against the Palestinians. And, obviously as socialists and, people who stand for human rights, we support self-determination. And Like, I mean, we want to see the Palestinians being able to self-govern and not being bullied around and told what they can do and can't do and being forced to have decisions made for them by, other governments. Like, that's just wrong. And, like, I was reading this Al Jazeera article, which is, oh, man, I have mixed feelings about it because it goes on into, like, how, you know, Keir Starmer and all of those people sort of reacted. And I was like, I don't care about their reactions. I'm far more concerned how, you know, the civilians of Palestine are feeling. How are the children feeling? You know, it's just, yeah, anyway, you know, I guess, you know, world leaders just have such a stage, don't they? And they can, yeah. Anyway.
On last week's show, I mean, I wasn't here, but I did hear a really good interview with Palestinian activist May Saif. So if listeners want to go back as well, because she's talking about Trump's neo-colonial peace, so-called peace deal for Gaza, and she does talk about, you know, how this ultimately presents no pathway for ending the genocide and guaranteeing Palestinian self-determination. So it's a good interview to go back and listen to.
Well, also, like, I mean, the IDF needs to be held accountable for their war crimes. Like, there needs to be, like, we need to see a dismantling of the apartheid system. It's not just enough to have a ceasefire. So I'm hopeful, but also...
And the siege. And the siege.
Like, we want to be hopeful, but at the same time, like, there's a lot that needs to be done to... have any sort of justice for Palestine. But just quickly, some of the details of the peace plan so far include, Israel and Hamas have both signed off on the first phase, but I think everything else is still under negotiations. So it includes all the captives are meant to be released very soon. I'm not sure if there's a timeline yet for that. There wasn't last night when I was looking at the news. Israel will withdraw their troops to an agreed upon line. And all parties will be treated fairly. Don't know what that means. Is that equally? and then the idea is to work towards a strong and durable peace agreement, but we will see.
I think the other thing about this plan that is just completely dodgy and unacceptable from the perspective of the Palestinian people is the imposition of a puppet government as part of this plan. So Hamas was, I believe it was 2005 or 2006, there was elections in Gaza, and Hamas was actually elected at those elections. There hasn't been elections since then, I would say in large part due to the you know, there's been repeated bombings of Gaza in 2012 and 2014 and the ongoing blockade of Gaza, which makes it very hard to hold elections there. Other people will be more critical of Hamas and say, well, maybe they could have held elections. Regardless, certainly going back 20 years, there was a definite popular mandate there. Part of this ceasefire deal is that the country that's been committing genocide and its allies are able to impose a puppet government on Gaza. And we also know that Trump and property developers have got their eyes on reconstruction. And this has been a running theme through the genocide as well, is that any aid coming into Gaza goes through Israel, and Israel profits from the on sending and distribution of that aid, and they will certainly have their eyes on doing the same thing as part of a puppet government reconstruction process. They're going to want contracts and potentially a sort of a creeping colonization and gradual taking over via the reconstruction process. So, and I think Hamas were sort of boxed into a corner, and they're like, look, we want a ceasefire. But without clearly saying no to that end of the deal, they've clearly raised concerns around that end of things, which is, I think, in the stage two or stage three of this ceasefire plan. So that's going to be one to watch. And I think this, again, emphasises the need for ongoing mobilisations. We can't just pack up and go home now that there's a ceasefire. There's been a genocide. There needs to be construction, and it needs to happen on just terms. It can't be done in such a way that results in this puppet apartheid government being established there and heaps of money flowing to profits for American and Israeli property developers as part of the reconstruction. That money needs to go where it's needed, and that is to the Palestinian people.
Yeah, yeah, it's disgusting. It's such a... a really just vivid example of capitalism actually at work in the Middle East. Like, literally, the US is trying to profiteer off the destruction of Palestine. That's what's happening, and it's really gross.
Well, we're going to go to a quick break and come back with more news. Stay with us.
On the 12th of October, we will be marching and commemorating 2 years of genocide, 2 years of resistance, and 2 years of steadfastness. The Palestinian people here in Na'am and the community will be marching together. We invite you all to join us and stand side by side to call for justice for the Palestinian people in Gaza, in Jerusalem, in Nablus, in Nafa, and in all the cities. We have been marching for the last 103 weeks back to back, calling for justice for Palestine and calling to sanction Israel. It is our duty to stand together with the oppressed. Join us on Sunday, 12th of October, at the State Library, 12 o'clock. And remember, always, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. أشد على أياديكم وأبوس الأرض تحت نعالكم وأقول أفديكم.
ThreeCR, always bringing you the latest union news.
They're coming after us at the moment. They want to get rid of penalty rates, the big push from businesses. They want to get rid of all the things that you and I have fought for.
So there's tens of thousands of jobs gone, contracted out to sham contracting arrangements.
On 8.55 a.m. and on the web, 3cr.org.au.
And welcome back to Green Left Radio on 3CR, 8.55 a.m. And we're going to go shortly to an interview with Sue Bull regarding an upcoming event, Relevance of Marxism Today. But before we do that, I thought we'd just quickly mention something that really grinds my gears, which is undemocratic processes and not allowing people to protest. Like, you know, this is all we have, people, is being able to protest and being able to withdraw our labour. They're basic rights in any democratic society. And so what's happened lately is in Gadigal country in Sydney, pro-Palestine activists have been denied or blocked being able to march to the Opera House this Sunday. And, of course, there's police who got up there and and then the courts unfortunately side with police, and so they've had to change where they're going to march to. And so there's been an agreement, well, I don't know how much of an agreement it is, it's probably under duress a bit, but Palestine Action Group and New South Wales Police have decided that the march will instead end at Belmore Park. It's just gross.
It's shameful.
Yeah, it is shameful. I mean, the fact that they need a permit to protest is just obscene. Like, Yeah, just the level of social control was just nuts. And, you know, they're really trying to introduce that kind of system into Melbourne. Alan would love that, I'm sure. but, yeah, it's just very concerning. So, yeah, solidarity, of course, to the Palestine Action Group in Sydney. And, yeah, I hope it's still a good rally this weekend. And, yeah, this isn't right.
The Opera House protest or attempt to protest there reminds me, Zane, you might remember the two activists. I was just reading an article recently because it was related to this protest. I don't know if listeners remember two activists who got up on the sale of the Opera House and painted No War. They had to organise like these big brushes.
Yeah.
And I think one of them was prepared to be deported. Like, there was a lot of organisation that went into it.
That's impressive.
The Iraq, protesting the Iraq war.
Yeah, wow. Mm.
Yeah, I know one of those people.
Oh, really?
Well.
Yeah. I knew it.
Yeah.
Of course you do.
Yeah, Dave Burgess. He does a lot of sort of climate and environment campaigning as well. And he was telling me the story that apparently. Dave and his mate were living in Sydney at the time, and I think they might have been going to uni or something like that. And they sort of said, "Oh, we should paint No War in the Opera House." And it was like,
"That sounds like a great conversation. I would have loved to have been there for that conversation."
And it was just like,
"It's like a really great canvas." It's like,
it is a blank canvas.
But it was a bit of a just like a, "Oh, wouldn't that be nice?" And then they were like, "Nah, but really." We should literally paint No War on the Opera House.
That's awesome.
And then they got serious about it and they actually did it. And
it
was pretty courageous, especially at that time, because there was this like total hysteria around terrorism and the cops. Like, you couldn't like put a bloody bottle of drink in the bin the wrong way without people being like, "Is that a bomb? Is that a terrorist?"
Yeah,
like,
it's a lot of paranoia.
So to climb up on the Opera House with climbing gear, like in that atmosphere of hysteria, was pretty courageous. But what an iconic moment.
Absolutely iconic. I hope it's on a postcard somewhere.
It should be.
Yeah, it should be.
So-called Australian, it's part of history here.
Yeah,
so.
But, I can really empathise as well. I feel like, trying to protest and prevent war, like, it can't, in my mind, it kind of justifies a lot of things, like a bit of civil disobedience and maybe a bit of creative, I suppose, vandalism.
Yeah. Anyway, solidarity to the protesters in Sydney that did, at Gadigal country, that did attempt to... march to Opera House, and they might be able to do it one day. I think that would be similar to the Harbour Bridge protest.
Absolutely.
But just before we head to our interview, just reminding listeners that there is a nationwide protest, Stand Up for Gaza, marking Israel's 2 years of genocide on Gaza.
Mm.
And there are rallies being held all around the country, so you can go to greenleft.org.au/events and find out where it's being held in your town or city. We're demanding Labour sanctions on Israel, ending the two-way arms trade and expelling the Israeli ambassador. Those are the main demands, so get in touch with your local activist groups to help out and help build the rally and show up.
Absolutely.
3CR. Stay tuned, stay radical.
We demand the full restoration of all Indigenous lands and resources, and we demand the immediate cessation of all forms of exploitation and destruction of our lands.
We're here to remind you of our sovereignty and our original demand from day one.
It started with intentional genocide of our people around the round table in England. It's all lies here. Everything's a lie. It's a great opportunity right now. Step into a sovereign, independent republic.
We demand a treaty. We demand our lands back. We demand to stop Black Death in custody.
And welcome back to Green Left Radio. You're listening to 3CR 855 AM. And with us joining us in the studio today is Sue Bull. Now, Sue is a long time. Hello, Sue.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you. And Sue is a, very long time activist and socialist, and unionist, staunch unionist, and a member of Socialist Alliance. And Sue is going to talk to us today a bit about the upcoming seminar, The Relevance of Marxism Today, which will be held on the 18th of October at the Maritime Union of Australia. Good morning, Sue.
Hi.
So would you like to tell us a bit about, like, why on earth should people give up their Saturday and come to a seminar about the relevance of Marxism today?
Well, we've been planning this for a while, but what we thought we'd do is have a one-day conference, if you like, looking at different aspects of Marxism, really not only as an educational, but to get people interacting with some of the ideas, which are all still very relevant today. Marxism, of course, is a 19th century political philosophy that is often sort of seen more today as something that was sort of theoretical, relevant 150-odd years ago, studied at universities today still, but, you know, largely a theoretical idea. But there are many, many people around the world who say, no, it's not just a 19th century theory. It actually has relevance because it's very scientific in its orientation. And even though some of the ideas that Marx and his comrade Engels put forward, some of the science that they used then has actually been developed much more fully today, and there's lots of information that has been added. But the basis of Marxism is still very relevant, because what they did, what the two of them were able to do, is use many, many scientific studies of the day and develop an approach which we call historical materialism. And most scientists today use something similar to the method that these two men were putting forward at the time and people still look at right now. So it's this idea that human beings live in a real world. They interact in their environment, and there's nothing religious or mystical about it. But our human societies change due to the interaction with that environment. And that then gives us a way of looking at the world to see if we can not only operate within it, but change it. And at a time like today, when there's so much happening, and a lot of it really is moving in a backward direction, this sort of helps many, many people see ways that they can pull together and change the nature of the world that we live in. So most Marxists are optimists, and we figure that we should be talking about these things right now.
Yeah, definitely. Hi, Sue. Chloe here.
Hi, Chloe.
Happy to give up my Saturday for what sounds like an excellent seminar, and thank you for organising it. The idea that the working class created by the capitalist system has the potential to liberate itself is really the core idea of Marxism, and we are all Marxists here. We're all going to be there. But can you tell us about some of the workshops or just the running of the day, what people can expect?
Yeah, okay. So that was one of the things I actually forgot to mention, Chloe, which you're absolutely right about. Where we cite ourselves is in as working class people, and really so much of what we look at is how working class people can change the world, because we are the 99%. So that's going to be one of the topics that we look at during the day. We're going to pose this question: so why is the working class revolutionary? How does it? Why do we say that it's possible that people who have really nothing can actually change the world for the better. So we are going to tackle that question. And we're also going to look at the way we can understand war, climate change and immigration. You know, some of the key questions now, the Palestine war, the fact that we are facing ecological ecocide, if you like, and indeed the nature of the anti-racism debates that we're seeing at the moment. And we're going to look at how capitalism actually creates those things. Because the critical thing about Marx is that his study was about capitalism. And it was he and Engels and all the people that supported them at the time saw capitalism as the real problem because it is profit-driven and it's destructive. So we're going to look at how that destructive nature creates war, climate change, etc., but also how we as working-class people can band together to change that. Like, and not just from an Australian point of view, but from an international point of view. So we're going to look at that. We're also going to look at how capitalism uses sexism and racism to try and divide working class people. So one of the things that we see today is terrible divisions between people where we fight amongst ourselves rather than against the 1% that own everything. So we want to start looking at, well, how did that come about? And why are some of those ideas so strong, even in a very rich country like Australia, which keeps us isolated from our neighbours and our communities rather than united within it? And I suppose there's two other critical things we're going to look at too. One is, what's the role of Lenin? So very often when people talk about Marxism, they go, oh, yeah, well, look, I can sort of see how what geniuses Marx and Engels were because, you know, they're using all the ideas of their time and putting it together. But, you know, Lenin, he's just, you know, the leader of a failed revolution. Well, we don't see him that way at all. We actually believe that Lenin was the one that first got together this idea or actually put forward ideas that led to a successful revolution and was part of a movement that was actually to win a successful revolution, even if only for a brief time. And his greatest contribution was that he began to write and experience how you win leadership of huge numbers of people as they move towards social change. How do you help build a disciplined group of people that help to steer that process in the right direction rather than in a destructive direction? And that will be where we also end our day when we look at, can spontaneous uprisings lead to socialist revolution? Because we've seen so many uprisings around the world, even as we speak now, but so many of those uprisings lead to not a positive outcome, but often a negative outcome. So what's the nature of that? How do we change that framework? How do we change that scenario? So, yes, that's where we're going to finish our discussion on Saturday. Oh, Saturday the 12th. Or which day is it? Saturday the 19th.
18th.
Oh, we got that. Right.
That's all right. It's still
working. Don't come on the wrong day, Sue.
But, yes, on Saturday the 18th, that's where we'll lead it. But I think we're going to be able to come together with a whole lot of ideas about ways that we can bring about positive social change rather than going in a direction which could lead to annihilation.
Sue, how are you going? It's Zane. Good to have you back. Hi, in the hood. One of the famous quotes from the bearded German gentleman was, as schools of war, the unions are unexcelled. Now, you're a long-term CFMEU activist and worked there for many years at the training unit. And I just was hoping you could comment on that in two ways. What do you think Marx was talking about when he says, as schools of war, the unions are unexcelled? Because I think this really plays into this idea that You can't just have spontaneous protests. If you want durable change and if you really want to liberate the working class from the harmful oppression of capitalism, you got to get really organized. And related to this, can you also comment on the ebb and flow of the union movement? There's been times like now where the union movement's a bit small, but what we've seen is as workers get confident, it's possible to rebuild a fighting union movement and rebuild fighting workers' parties and grow them to be quite large and powerful in a relatively short period of time.
Oh. Well, Zane, we've actually got a session on this.
You'll be pleased to know.
Jackie Chris is one of our wonderful nurses activists. I don't know if you realise, but the nurses are now the biggest union in Australia.
Wow.
But we are going to be looking at that because we're going to look at, okay, well, why do Marx and Engels put so much emphasis on the working class? You know, as the which of course today we often refer to as the 99%. Why do they say that these people who own no property, who own nothing beyond their labour power, which they sell in the workplace, how can they actually lead a successful revolution? And one of the ways that we attempt to train, if you like, or steal people in the capacity to do that is through unions. So from the time of Marx and Engels through Lenin until today, working class people have very often been part of the union movement. And of course, being in a union can teach you so many things. Unions, by the way, are not, of course, revolutionary in their projection, but they actually can help working class people come together, unify, and in the end, understand the nature of fighting together. So that's one of the things that unions can actually impart to their members. Sadly, at the moment, of course, in the Australian situation, there's only about 8% of us in unions, and we're actually experiencing a lot of defeats because the other side of unions in the Australian context and pretty much worldwide, they're very often linked to social democratic parties like the Australian Labor Party, who actually use the unions as shock troops to just keep getting elected. But they see them as a recruiting base to keep themselves, the other bourgeois government party, in power. So there's a constant struggle within unions for workers on the one hand to remain independent and fight for their own best interests, and bureaucrats who want the unions to just become, a base for them to get re-elected into parliament very often. And in fact, you've probably all seen it, but so many union leaders are just slowly, that their next career jump is from being head of the union into parliament, the old mummy into parliament stuff. Of course, as a CFMEU activist, it's really hard for us at the moment because our union's sitting in administration, which is very much like an experience of deregistration, which construction workers have had experience before. And Jackie will talk about these sort of things because, sadly for us at the moment in Australia, the loss of the CFMEU as a leader, as a militant leader within the union movement, has meant that we're a bit rudderless in terms of helping working class people fight back against the constant attacks on their safety, on their working conditions, and, of course, on their pay. So, we are going to talk about those contradictions, and we are going to talk about whether we can overcome them. You know, what's the role of independent leaderships like the recent victory that many comrades experienced within the CPSU, which is now an independent union, independent from the Labor Party, under Giselle Hannah and her group. You know, can those sort of things be successful, and can they be the seeds of fighting back in a more generalised way?
Yeah.
Because if we don't learn to fight back, we will find that we can't pull working class people together.
Yeah, well, we hope that's whet people's appetite to show up on Saturday the 18th October from 9 a.m. till 5. And thanks, Sue, for joining us on the show. And we're all looking forward to discussing the relevance of Marxism in building socialist politics today. The address again is Maritime Union of Australia on Ireland Street in West Melbourne. It's easy to get to by train or walking there from the city even. And you can find more details at greenleft.org.au/events. Thanks, Sue.
Thanks, Sue.
Great. Thank you. Bye-bye.
This is a rapacious expansion of privatisation, which is going to change the face of the city that we live in.
It's not share, it's not making the housing crisis go away. It's really about the big end of town. It's a shame job.
It's a transfer. It's a theft of public wealth, which is going to worsen the housing crisis.
The government is giving public land to private developers. Why would you do that? Why would you give all these assets over to the biggest bully in town?
We're looking down at a future that we don't know what's going to happen. Where are we going to get moved to? Dandenong, or away from our communities and away from the services that we need?
This is a line in the sand for not only the public housing tenants, but for a Victorian society.
3CR, here to stay.
We're not meant to have anything nuclear in our country.
It's really important and urgent that Australia get serious about nuclear disarmament.
Well, nobody anywhere on the planet has figured out how to deal with highly radioactive waste.
Most of those who've managed nuclear weapons consider this to be the most dangerous time that we've ever lived in, with the danger of nuclear war at unprecedented levels.
You're listening to Radical Radio 3CR.
You're back listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR, and we have our next guest on the program, writer and artist Nathan Bell from Mullumbimba, or Newcastle, to speak about his new book, 1 Minute to Midnight. Welcome to the show, Nathan.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Hey, good to have you back on. So, Nathan, we spoke to you a couple of years back about your book, Kings of the New Age. And Kings of the New Age also dealt with the subject matter of your more recent book, 1 Minute to Midnight, which is nuclear war. Can you comment on, or can you give us a bit of an overview of 1 Minute to Midnight and talk about how it relates to your previous book?
Well, with 1 Minute to Midnight, I wanted to capture what it would be like in the moments that that war broke out, and the fear that an individual and the community would feel as that that shock of that revelation that the nuclear war was actually occurring. So it follows a man in Newcastle as the war breaks out, and he flees Newcastle to be with his family, and it follows him fleeing back to the Maitland area to be with his family. Then it follows the family sitting around basically waiting, unfortunately, to die from radioactive fallout. And it's a really tragic story. There's certainly nothing nice about it. But, yeah, I think that's the terror that we would experience in those moments if it actually came to that war happening. It does relate to Kings of the New Age in that it's a statement about nuclear weapons and the dangers of nuclear war. But, of course, Kings of the New Age has highly mythical, magical themes. And there is, in Kings of the New Age, there is this magical remedy to heal the world from radiation poisoning. But in 1 Minute to Midnight, there isn't any of that. There's just the grim reality of the devastation that that war would wreak on the planet.
Yeah, I found this a very interesting dynamic. And part of the way that I became interested in politics sort of nearly 25 years ago is I became interested in conspiracy stuff and the Illuminati, and I was starting to get kind of red-pilled. And then I eventually was able to move away from that into more sort of left-wing politics. And I find the combination of your two books is very interesting in this regard, because Kings of the New Age I think is well suited to people who are grasping for an explanation of what's going on in the world. They're scared by some of what's happening in the world, and by being mystical, it's a bit more disarming and it welcomes people from kind of different headspaces. But then with your second book, 1 Minute to Midnight, you kind of, it's almost like an off-ramp, and you take people into this more sort of serious thing and be like, but seriously though, if we have a nuclear war, it's going to be really bad and there's not going to be any magical way to fix the problem.
That's exactly right. There's no magical solution in 1 Minute to Midnight. It's just the grim, serious reality that if a nuclear war happens, a large-scale nuclear war, probably a large portion of the planet's population will die, and it will be absolutely terrifying. And that's just the reality of it, and that's what the book confronts, rather than the magical themes that are present in Kings of the New Age.
Hmm. One of the aspects of your 1 Minute to Midnight is I think you've got quite this compelling portrayal of the sort of chaos. And so in the book, the conflict around Ukraine and sort of in the Middle East, it all sort of escalates and ends up in a nuclear conflagration. And one of the things that you describe is we sort of got a glimpse of this in the pandemic with the people fighting over groceries and toilet paper in the shops. One of the parts of your book, I think, is this really disturbing and compelling picture of people really freaking out, getting in their cars and trying to flee the cities as this war takes place. Can you talk a bit about that?
Well, I think obviously people would panic, because most people are very mentally unprepared for this sort of situation, because I think unfortunately a lot of people sort of drift through life without much awareness of these sorts of realities of global conflict. You know, we live in a very comfortable part of the world in the West where we're not confronted every day with war and we're not confronted with these grim realities of the world. And so people don't know how to handle it when these things do come up. So I think if it actually did come to that, you would see a chaos break out in the community, and people would panic and there would be riots and there would be a lot of people with the mentality of what does it matter anymore? We might as well just sort of go mental. And trying to get to family and trying to gather supplies. Because I think it, as I said, it's a big part of the comfort we live in the West, where we're not confronted with warfare and devastation on a regular basis, so people don't know how to respond in a calm way.
Yeah, Nathan, Chloe here. I read your book and I enjoyed reading it, even though it is a grim story. And thanks for sending it to us. We've got it here in the studio with us, and it does give us a real insight into your everyday life, and the people in it, and how everything can just change with a catastrophe caused by the mass detonation of nuclear weapons, and this leading to widespread destruction and the anticipation of, you know, the bombs coming for us, and I think it was good that you mentioned radiation and the long term, you know, the societal collapse around that and the environmental destruction. Because you do talk about losing loved ones to radiation poisoning. I think that's important because it's not just about bombs one day. You probably know about the history of nuclear testing, and particularly in the Pacific, and the campaigns to stop that, because there's been so many, well, millions of cancer deaths that are related to the radiation that's been due to nuclear testing. So, yeah, I thought that was really interesting, and, I like how it sort of, well, yeah, it was good how you sort of took us through your journey of sort of having to come to terms with the end of your life and every end life as we know it.
Well, that's what the whole point of the story was to give you the perspective of an individual who one minute is in the middle of their everyday normal life, and then the next minute is thrust into this situation of absolute madness, and then within a few days is faced with the reality that they are about to die. It was meant to be the perspective of an individual experiencing those moments and reflecting on that reality, which is why the book is written as a letter penned by a man reflecting on those things for anyone who survives to find that letter and to read it and to know what that experience was like.
Hmm.
Yeah, and you also referred to the military air base, which is near Newcastle where you live, which was also good because it does link Australia's role in the military industrial complex. And I thought that was important to sort of, yeah, not trying to give the whole story away, but, you know, there was fear that the people in the town were talking about, well, they're gonna come and bomb the, you know, we've got a military base here and now we're a target because of that.
Well, that's right. The RAF base makes us an obvious target, which is concerning because it means the whole area could be wiped out. I'd certainly prefer there not be a base there to draw attention to our area. Absolutely.
Hmm. I feel like part of the role of this work is to really use art to try and spark the imagination of people who haven't otherwise thought about the seriousness of nuclear war. Can you, kind of comment on that a bit?
Yeah, well, that's what a lot of what I do is about. Now, I've been producing content themed around nuclear war for many years. I had a band, Hadron C, in my 20s, and I released a music video called Apocalyptic Nightmare, which followed a man fleeing a city during a nuclear war. I also released numerous other anti-war songs under the name Hadron C. I've got clothing designs that deal with nuclear weapons and deproliferation. I absolutely intend to use art to get people thinking, particularly people who aren't already thinking about those things, and to spark their imagination and to get them engaged in politics. And that's what I try to do with the majority of the art that I produce. For me, art is a tool to get people thinking and to engage people in the issues. I do also produce some pop content, which has nothing to do with politics, but majority of my work is political or make some sort of social statement to engage people.
And how do you think we can, what does it look like for the 99% to push to establish a world where nuclear weapons are banned? And how do we make that happen? It's obviously a big question, I don't know, but I'm sure you've reflected on this.
Well, all we can do is keep advocating and keep lobbying and form groups and associations that pressure government, because really our only power is to pressure government. But honestly, I've become a bit cynical in my old age because I see that governments repeatedly ignore their populations, and it scares me because I worry that we're not going to be able to get to that point where we can pressure the government to get rid of the nuclear weapons. You know, we've just seen in Trump's first presidency that he stepped away from some of the treaties that were important for limiting the missiles used with nuclear warheads. So it seems to keep going back and forth. And some way it seems we're coming into a new Cold War era. But we can only keep advocating and keep pushing government with our pressure groups.
Yes, and one of those pressure groups is the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. And am I right, did you send a copy of your book to them?
I did, and a gentleman there got back to me and said he was very impressed with it and he thoroughly enjoyed it, so that was very good.
Yeah, nice. And what's next in your... Are you working on any new books at the moment?
Well, I've got 5 published short stories now. I've got around 4 other short stories which I'll be publishing over the next year. And I've written a second novel, which I'm trying to get a traditional publisher for rather than self-publishing. Plus, I've always got music in production and always many other things that I'm doing around media. So I'm always creating new content, so keep a lookout.
Nathan, where can people get a hold of your books? Or how can people get copies?
They can be ordered on Amazon, so it's print on demand. If you place an order, Amazon will post it out to you.
Yeah, nice. And, look, if there's anyone listening who's interested in getting into self-publishing, what's your overview of that? How have you found that?
I found it very effective. The Amazon service has worked really well for me. The only thing I would say about self-publishing is I've worked for about 4 years to sell about 3,000 books, and I've had to be very proactive about getting out in the community and selling my books to people. So self-publishing is a lot of hard work. I say it can work out well, and I've built a good audience for my content. But I would honestly say, after the work I've done, if you can get a traditional publisher who will publish your work and take that workload for you, I would recommend doing it that way.
Yeah, nice. All right. Well, definitely check out 1 Minute to Midnight. And what are your other... there's 1 Minute to Midnight, Kings of the New Age. You've said you've got 5 books. What are the other 3?
I've got Saturday Night on Beaumont Street. I've got The Wizard and the Eye Man. I've got Shamanic Journey. And I've got The Wizard Spell. So there's actually 6 books now, 5 short stories and Kings of the New Age.
Yeah, rock and roll. All right. Well,
thanks, yes. Nathan, for joining us on the program this morning. And if listeners would like to know more, hear more from Nathan, you can check out the YouTube channel Nathan Bell and the Revolutionaries and read his new book, 1 Minute to Midnight. And any last comments before we let you go, Nathan?
No, let's just work towards a world of peace and love.
Word.
Oh. Thank you, Nathan. And you've requested a song. Sorry.
Yes, yes, yes. We're going to play a song with one of your musical collaborators over the years, the one and only Ezekiel Ox.
Thanks, guys.
Word. All right. Catch you next time. Cheers, Nathan.
See you, guys. Have a great day.
See you, Nathan.
Get there, I hope that I find friends. I hope they understand.
Welcome back. You are listening to 3CR. You're listening to 3CR. It's 8:55 a.m. on your AM dial. It's also online, of course. And you've just been listening to Machine Guns Firing by the one and only Ezekiel Ox. And before that, we were having our news, also Nathan Bell. And it is that time of morning once again on Green Left Radio for you to listen
to the activist calendar. Drum roll. Yeah, no, we try and make it exciting. But also, I often think back to, like, you know, probably once upon a time where, you know, people were more reliant on newspapers and listening to radio to make sure they got all the events. So anyway, back to the good old days. Not so good. Well, mixed bag for people. Anyway, I digress. Let's talk about the activist calendar. So what is on this week? It would be helpful if Steph had the right page up. We will get there. There we go. Okay. So, of course, this Sunday, really important. It's a nationwide march for Palestine, 12 p.m. at the State Library in Melbourne. And we are talking about events in Melbourne on obviously, for other events around the country, please go to greenleft.org.au/events. And then at 4 p.m., there's in solidarity with Palestine, location to be announced, but you can find out details on our website. Did you want to?
Monday, October 13, there is a reading circle, Political Economy of Palestine. That's at 10 a.m. at Monash Whole Fields, level one. Monash Whole Foods. Not Whole Fields. 21 Chancellor's Walk at Monash Uni. And then there's another reading circle, Political Economy in Palestine, at 6 p.m. at the Institute of Postcolonial Studies, 78 to 80 Curzon Street, North Melbourne. That's also on Monday the 13th coming up.
Awesome. So there's lots of other events on. I'll just highlight some of them. So there's also a forum on Friday, October 17th, Palestine Betrayal, Reporting on a Modern Day Genocide at 6 p.m. at RMIT. And next Sunday on the October the 19th is the anti-racism rally. So rally, no room for racism and fascism, no white Australia, counter the far right, 11 a.m. at the State Library in the city.
Yes, very important to get a good turnout to that, because that is always your primary defensive weapon against the fascists is big numbers.
Mm. Yeah. Just looking at some of the events here. Oh, a film screening. I'm just sort of skipping ahead a little bit just because there are...
October 20.
Can I just mention, I know it conflicts with the Marxism seminar, but Saffron Kingdom is showing at Cinema Nova Carlton on the 18th of October to 2:30 p.m. I don't think we've put it in the Green Left events yet, but it's in our activist calendar. So we'll add that and people can find out where to book, how to book tickets, but you can buy them at the door.
Saffron Kingdom.
Yeah, it's a film by a Kashmiri filmmaker, Sheikh Arafat, who attempts to reclaim the storytelling and challenge the overwhelming propaganda produced by the Indian film industry, with Bollywood being at the forefront and of normalizing the military occupation of Kashmir. So it's a good one to support as well.
Yeah. And so just talking about some other events, so not Palestine related necessarily, although they're all related in a sense. Today we've got, and I know 3CR is, I think, also supporting this possibly, is a fundraiser for Rising Red Lantern and Unshackled, which is a culture and creativity through food, art and music to support Asian migrant sex workers at 5 p.m. at Vixen, 5 Merrifield Street, Brunswick. So that's on tonight.
Nice.
Yeah.
Shout out to all the sex workers out there. It's a dangerous industry and it's still criminalized and it's not cool. And it's important to further, decriminalize the industry and normalize it and make sure that sex workers are safe and visible and respected.
Yeah, absolutely. There is another... Palestine ish event on tomorrow. So, October 11th, Saturday, community event, Palestinian and Black folk songs and stories. That sounds awesome. 10:30 a.m. at, I don't know if I, is it Neshi or N E C C H I in East Coburg neighborhood house? Oh, I see. Yeah, okay. 32 Nicholson Street, Coburg. Then, of course, there's a smoking ceremony at 2:30 p.m. this Sunday at Camp Sovereignty on the King's Domain. Other things coming up. Environmental Film Festival. That sounds good. Next week, so October 16th till Thursday, October the 23rd. And so there's various times and locations, but encourage listeners to check that out.
Hopefully they're screening the Rising Tide film Turning the Ship as part of that, which I still haven't seen, and I'm very excited to check that out.
Yeah, awesome. That sounds great. And then, of course, we've got our seminar on next Saturday, October the 18th, The Relevance of Marxism Today, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Maritime Union of Australia. That's 46 to 54 Island Street, West Melbourne.
Alrighty. And we've got an interview coming up pretty soon.
Do you want to just play that song that you want to play while we get them on the line?
Yeah, sure. So a good friend of mine who I've known for many years, Wasabi, unfortunately died in a truck accident about a month ago. And Wasabi was the DJ in Combat Wombat. And this is probably my favorite Combat Wombat jam. It's called Star Wars. And it's 20 years old, but it's sadly still very relevant today. And shout out to Wasabi and to all those who knew him who are, feeling the pain of our good friend being gone.
Well, the Defence Minister of Australia, Robert Hill, says the government's continuing to talk to the US about Australia developing a missile defence system. Earlier this year, the government revealed it was considering whether a shield could be put in place to protect Australia against possible missile attacks.
Star Wars.
The Empire Strikes Back.
War is terrorism. Star Wars.
The Empire Strikes Back.
War is
terrorism.
Star Wars.
The Empire Strikes Back.
War is
terrorism.
Star Wars.
The Empire Strikes Back.
Star Wars, the Empire Strikes Back to attack. For what's it got to lose? I bruise on the ego of the president and the residents of the Pentagon's military defense extravagance. Undermined by the strife of an Arab with a pen, not prepared to take his own life. And everybody's home to roam. End up pain created by
Stars warring on CNN again. Showdown of the lowdown. Dirty rap versus a dingbat. He's all that in check shirt and riding chaps. The emperor has no clothes, there's no denying that. Let's take the power back without the flowers crap. These motherfuckers got me ready to snap. They only got their own back. We take our own back or seek fantasy as our dignity's attacked. Where you wanna end up, first place or last? Left suffocating as their rocket ship blasts. No life on Mars, but none here either. A global holocaust as they glide through the ether. I'm a believer, realist and truth seeker. Knowledge is power as it pumps through the speaker. Dismissal of a morally bankrupt leader is needed, cause identities lie bleeding.
Star Wars.
The Empire Strikes Back.
War is
terrorism.
Star Wars.
The Empire Strikes Back.
War is
terrorism.
A CIA conspiracy. It might be, it's hard to see. A clear picture, just a fixture. At the end of the media, hype and tripe on the television. No clarity of vision. Is this World War III? Is this a reality? We're living in, giving in, killing in each other. Secretly exploiting the minority, creating targets for revenge, justification to avenge race, war, religious war. Did they tell you what you're fighting for? You seem to have forgotten.
Conscious awareness, that's in question, no more guessing. Tired of being ignored, the shadow definitely flexing. I'm dealt with making a world like a shoot 'em up western. In a mad escalating session of aggression and a war thirst with no lesson from the past. We blast, carpet bomb and ask, why do they hate us and make us escape nuts? Wake up, why not we bash them, crash them, smash them, ask friends to help us in our task for revenge. Send in men to end all dissent, sent. Bringing a cream of militant to distinguish the innocent. Trust, our premise is the nemesis is dust, a must. Sending enough trucks, tanks, missiles abrupt. Drop bombs till there's nothing around to blow up. Sending enough of our best tanks, trucks, missiles and such. Drop bombs till there's nothing around to blow up. Drop bombs till there's no one left but friends meeting us. Whole planet seething, obviously angered. America's righteous constitution gets mangled. Daily operation as a commentator spray. Verbal Agent Orange if you get in their way. Paid in full to back the bending of rules. When fools take power, their swords indeed cruel. Nothing new, this Christian empire finds that Jesus was indeed born in Palestine. Remind, remind, remind yourself that history is written by the man with wealth. But he is passionless next to those who felt the rough hand the corrupt man has dealt. Where's the next target? Civilian market? Pursue those goals and fuck the families that cark it. The whole sky is filled with immense darkness. Where's the love? Is it too much to ask this?
Different ideology rule like a toxic stew. Religious fundamentalists look to argue. Different ideology rule like a toxic stew. Mad politicians them love to argue.
Hezbollah in the public, we think you realize an intifada. War between with the Muslim, Christian, Hindu, India, Pakistan, Korea, all the way, Australia, all the brain, making way brave for the big fire. Temperature around the globe, watch it grow hotter. More guns, more blood clots, like the Black Empire. With the plot, keep it stuck like blood for vampire. From the big to the weak, this is guided power. Star Wars never gonna prevent no more falling tower. How long to them come cage you? Different ideology will like a toxic snow. Religious fundamentalists love to argue. Different ideology.
of today's world. World peace.
All right, you're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR, and that was Star Wars by Combat Wombat. And shout out to Wasabi, the DJ off that track, who is sadly no longer with us. And shout out also to Elf and Izzy and Mark from Combat Wombat, who will be hurting now that their stablemate is no longer with us. Apologies, because there was a couple of spicy words in that one that we forgot about. So hopefully they didn't injure your tender ears.
Little ears.
Yeah. So we're now being joined by Helly, who is the general manager of Coalition for the Protection of Racehorses. Helly, it's so good to have you joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, absolutely wonderful to talk to you. And I've just been, really looking forward to this interview, actually. I really wish we didn't need to have this interview at the same time, as lovely as it is to talk to you. But can you tell us and tell our listeners a little bit about the Coalition for the Protection of Racehorses and how you came to be involved?
Yeah, absolutely. The coalition started out in 2008, where our campaign director, Elio Cilotto, came across a yard outside a knackery in a rural area that was just filled with racehorses that were waiting to be slaughtered. And it occurred to him that even though this is such a massive industry in Australia, there was no groups really dedicated to advocating for these animals. So that's how it started out. And since we've been investigating and exposing the cruelty of the racing industry, we do a lot of work to lobby for change. We try as hard as we can to create awareness, not just with the public, but also politically, and try to just communicate with authorities and industry people on how we can make a positive change for these animals.
Yeah, and it's such immensely important work. And can you just sort of, if it's okay, just give a little overview of some of the issues. Like, what are these poor horses experiencing as a result of racing?
Yeah, well, I need several hours to go through that. Well, yeah. I suppose we can start with the issue of wastage, as the industry calls it, because it is probably the worst issue that the industry acknowledges as well. The thing is, this industry is utterly unsustainable. They rely on breeding an excess amount of horses in order to find those few that has the ability to do well on the racetrack. And then all their horses live to be around 25 years of age. They only use the horses for a short period of time, and then they rely on other people to take them on when they're done on the racetrack. And as you can imagine, that math just doesn't add up we're adding an extra 10,000 horses a year to the equestrian market. The homes are simply not out there. And obviously we have the horses that never make it onto the racetrack in the first place. And we don't have any transparency into where these horses end up. So we've got a massive oversupply of horses, unfortunately. None of them have done anything wrong. There's simply just not homes enough for them. It's a part of a bigger issue of having animals in profit-driven industries. Welfare will always come second, and it doesn't matter how nice the trainers are or how much they They love their horses. The fact of the matter is they have paychecks that needs to be paid. They have rent to pay. And you simply can't run a business if you want to do right by these animals.
Yeah.
So it's like any other business that involves animals. And it's really sad. And if you keep in mind that this is it's not an essential industry that we depend upon to survive. It is purely for human entertainment and gambling purposes that this even exists.
Yeah. God, it's so heartbreaking talking about this. And I think the awful thing is, like, you know, when we're talking about wastage or, you know, animals that can't be homed, I think we can guess what where they end up. And it's awful. It's really awful.
In 2019, we ended a 2-year investigation into slaughterhouses in Australia, where from that investigation we could estimate that at least 5,000 racehorses a year are killed at slaughterhouses around Australia. And following that exposure that was published by the ABC, it came out in a documentary that was called The Dark Side of the Horse Racing Industry in Australia. It caused a public outcry because obviously the public didn't like seeing these horses that the industry likes to promote with their names and have them become stars when they're on the racetrack, and then all of a sudden they saw where they actually ended up at the end of their careers. And it made the industry in a few states around the country implement new rules that horses weren't allowed to be sent directly to slaughter. However, that hasn't done much. Now we're seeing middlemen who will buy up horses at auctions and then ship them to slaughter, and we're seeing even more horses that are being killed on site, so they never even go in that direction. Banning horses from being sent directly to slaughter, it doesn't change the fact that we still need homes for these many horses.
Yeah.
And the number has not gone down, sadly. So one of our many campaigns is to try and get a cap on breeding, so that not that many horses will be ending up in these situations.
I wanted to ask you a question slightly off script here, Hilly, and if you don't want to answer it, that's completely fine. But my sort of sense as, like, someone who, is an animal rights advocate and vegan, and I love horses, love all animals. I guess, like, one of the things that I've really noticed, and I find it so encouraging, but I'd be curious about if this matches your experience, is just if you've noticed, like, an increase in, like, concern for horses, and even, like, a boycott of horse racing among the general population. Do you feel like there's more support for horses and horse racing?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like just within this last decade, there's two things to it. Firstly, a lot of research has been done into just the nature of horses that's become more common knowledge. Australians are like to know things, and when we know better, we do better. So that's one of the things, obviously, that we're very happy to see, and we encourage people to learn as much as they can. But also around the spring racing carnival that's coming up, one of our biggest campaigns is our Nut to the Cup campaign that is full rolling at the moment. And for each year, we are getting more and more events set up and more people who participate in them. And I'll just tell you what it's about. We're basically just offering people a meaningful alternative to betting on the races or attending horse races. So sure that people can still have a wonderful, good time, dress up with their silly hats if they like to, just without the cruelty. So we party in the cool way. And all across the country, people are setting up events. So you'll be able to attend one, basically almost no matter where you are. So you're not forced to participate in the office stakes or anything like that on the day. And I think it's absolutely wonderful to see so many people just wanting to make it into a day where we celebrate animals, where we have a good time and don't support the cruelty.
Yeah, awesome. Such a brilliant campaign as well. And just the name is just nuts with the cup. I love it. It just rolls off the tongue. Yeah. Before we wind up, Helly, I just wanted to ask, because you sent me this amazing booklet of just like some of the common objections that people raise when we discuss ending horse racing, and just, you know, what some responses can be to that. Did you want to just sort of go over that a little bit?
Oh, yeah, well, there's quite a few. I think one of the most common ones from the industry is, well, what about the thousands of people who are employed in this industry? If we close it down, what are they going to do? It's just not a valid argument for continuing an industry that is inherently cruel. We can see from history, we used to have slaves, we used to have child labour. Once upon a time, it was legal for teachers to strike kids if they didn't do their homework. And, you know, these things are morally wrong and we move away from them. Mm. And it's a transition. People in the horse racing industry will also be able to transition away and find a more sustainable way of living that doesn't involve cruelty. And I think that's just important to remember that it's not an argument for keeping something going that is inherently cruel.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose
another one, if I could just mention that one, one that we hear so often, that hear trainers and owners say, well, these horses are treated like royalty. They live like kings and queens better than we do. Also here, we need to think that that might be right from a human perspective, but not from the animal. Horses like to roam freely in a field with a trusted herd, and they don't see the luxury of having being locked up in a stable, although it's nice and clean. They'd much prefer to roll in the dirt and be with their friends. No matter how many massages or expensive supplements and blankets and whatnot that you put on them that we think is luxurious, it's not luxurious in the eyes of a horse. And I think more and more people understand this. And obviously they are well looked after whilst they are racing. The problem is that they usually, on average, 2 to 3 years, they last on the racetrack, then they are no longer of any use to the industry, and then they don't take responsibility for their welfare anymore. So we know how that goes.
Yeah, absolutely. Helly, thank you so much for joining us. And I suppose I was just sort of thinking, in a parting comment, just, you know, horses are mammals. We all want, and like all living animals, we want to be free. We want liberation and we want to be sociable. And horses are no different. It's really essential for their well-being, as it is for ours. And so, Helly, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a fantastic interview. Do you have any...
Cheers, Helly.
Just visit our website, knoptothecup.org.
Awesome.
And find an event so that you can join in on in the movement for kindness over cruelty. That would be fantastic.
Yeah, fabulous. Thank you so much, Helly. Thank you
for having me on.
Oh, absolute pleasure.
Bye.
Bye. Oh, that was lovely. So that was an interview with Helly from General Manager. She's the General Manager of Coalition for the Protection of Racehorses, and she was talking about, they actually run multiple campaigns, but we're mainly talking about Nup to the Cup, and given that spring racing is just around the corner, and all the cruelty that entails. So yeah,
I got Nup to the Cup. I think it's a song ready, but we don't have enough time to play because we're just coming to the end of the show. So
yeah.
I really want to thank listeners for tuning in this week. We want to thank our guests, Marxist activist Sue Bull from Socialist Alliance, writer, artist Nathan Bell, and lastly, Helly, who just heard, General Manager of Coalition for Protection of Racehorses. And thank you to Zane and Steph for getting up early.
Thank you for getting up early.
Yeah, Chloe. I think you have to come further. And also, Chloe gets here super early to set everything up and panel. And,
to beat the traffic, really.
And she is amazing.
It's nice and quiet.
We're so glad to have you back.
Yeah. Good on you,
good
comrade.
Good to be back. See you on the street. See you at the Palestine rally this Sunday.
Be there.
Yeah, stick around for Left After Breakfast.
This brings us to the end of the show. You have been listening to Friday Morning Breakfast with Green Left Radio, brought to you by Green Left Weekly Newspaper, which brings an alternative source of information that puts people and planet before profit.
If you like our work, become a supporter from $5 per month at greenleft.org.au/support or free call 1-800-634-206.
Arise, you workers from your slumbers. Arise, you prisoners of want. For reason in revolt now thunders and at last ends the age of Khan. Away with all your superstition.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.